here a little bit. Thank you again so much, Dick. I'm going to ask you, as I'm speaking, when I get down to about 5 minutes left, I want you to give me a sign, but the sign is going to be to tell her to say, hey, buddy, bring it down for a landing. So you just yell that out when he tells you. And that will be good. I'm actually going to bring this down there. Is that better? Good, okay. First of all, the commercial. Dick had mentioned the two books that we have from myself. These are two of the most recent books that I have. This one, The Ring Makes All the Difference, The Hidden Consequences of Cohabitation, and The Strong Benefits of Marriage. This is a really practical, research-based book that talks about why unmarried cohabitation is not a good idea. Not from a moral point of view, but from just the best social sciences. And the social sciences on this, the mainstream secular social science, are just categorically opposed to cohabitation. That is, if you want a good, healthy relationship. I don't know of any research finding that says that cohabitation is a good idea in terms of quality of the relationship. So this tells that story, but then it also tells the backstory of marriage is a good thing, and that there are great benefits to marriage. So it talks about the problems with cohabitation, that it's not a good idea from a practical standpoint, but the benefits of marriage itself for adults and children. And then Dick, slides on the next one. Never mind that. And then this second book is actually my latest, Loving My LGBT Neighbor, Being Friends in Grace and Truth. And I wrote this book as a way to help all of us deal with this issue, the issue that we're going to be talking about this weekend. But how do we do it in standing in absolute, uncompromising truth, but then at the same time being gracious to individuals who find themselves in this world? Can we do that? Can we stand for truth, and can we stand with grace as well? And I write out of it, not just theoretically, but out of the work that I've done of standing for these issues, but also having a number of friends on the other side of this issue, and us disagreeing, but having a good, decent relationship, and learning out of that experience how to do that, still making lots of mistakes, but just learning through that process over years. And so it's a very practical book that teaches us and helps us to learn how to love our same-sex attracted family member, coworker, neighbor, even people in our church. How do we navigate these issues? So these two are back there, and you can get them signed after you purchase them for no extra charge. I was telling somebody one time, I'm selling books, and I asked this lady if she'd like for me to sign it. And she goes, well, what, are you famous or something? And I said, good for you, good for you. You're not being caught up in all the hype. So I hope that you will enjoy those books. We're going to have four talks this weekend, two tonight, two tomorrow, as you can see in your schedule. The first one tonight is just simply what I'm calling Tales from the Road. And for the last 15 years, I have gone out to secular campuses of my own choice and to go out and to debate and address the issue of same-sex attraction, same-sex marriage, just the LGBT and gender issues. And it's fun. I think it's fun, honestly, because I'm the guy from Focus on the Family. Okay, so on the secular campus, we know the people from Focus on the Family. They're goofy. They don't read any other book than the Bible. They are basically flat earthers, and they're hateful, and they're mean, and they're bigoted. You know, so the audience is like, okay, we can deal with this guy. And what's fun about it is to not be the person that they think you are, which is not that difficult. And I'll tell you some stories about that, which is really just fascinating. But I'm the one at Focus that gets to go out and do these kinds of things. And I like it. I actually don't get to speak to groups like you very much, good, sensible Christian people or in churches, because I'm usually out at secular campuses. And it's important for us to do that. And people ask, well, I mean, my goodness, Glenn, how do you do that? How can you be that smart to know everything that they may throw at you? And to be honest with you, and this is how I get to do it, you don't have to be that smart, because I am not that smart. And this is why. Because typically on secular college campuses, they, on any of these issues, they have about five things that they say. And they're just like these little bumper sticker statements. Well, isn't it hateful to be? And if you learn how to just respond to these five or six different things, they're not ever going to throw anything at you that you haven't thought about. In fact, in many ways, you're like, please, audience, I mean, give me something a little more complex than just your bumper sticker talking points. But when I have gone with some of my opponents on the other side to Christian campuses, the Christian kids, they will ask sort of the, you know, in the box questions that, you know, are sort of the bumper sticker questions, but they tend to ask the brighter, more thoughtful questions. And get this, they tend to be more respectful to my opponent than I am treated at the secular colleges. That's very, very interesting. I want to tell you a story that going out and debating this issue in you know, college campuses over the years, I have made good friends on the other side. There are some people that I debate, and I'll just be honest with you, you know, like, you're just an intellectual thug. You know, you're not trying to engage this issue. And we have some of those people on our side. For them, it's just all about winning. And it's not about winning. It's about influencing and shaping and getting them to think in a little different way. But some of the people that I debate, they're good people. They try to be honest. They try to be consistent about what it is they're saying. They don't try to be so slippery. And I will develop friendships with these people. After we debate, we'll go out and, you know, I'll say, that third point you make, how can you even believe that? I mean, you're smarter than that, you know? And they'll say the thing to me, and we have these kinds of relationships. What's cool about it is the more we develop these friendships between us, the two people who disagree, the more aggressively we can go after each other. Think about that. Well, you're becoming more friends, so wouldn't you become kinder? It really comes down to this. When you're at the Thanksgiving table with your family, and there's crazy Uncle Harold, and there's the, you know, slacker cousin there, and if it's just you guys, you can just go off on each other, right? But if there's a visitor at the table outside of the family, everybody's on their best behavior. When you're comfortable with one another and you know each other and we're friends and we're not going, you can just go after each other. That is the same way with these friendships that I have with people on the other side. We have proven ourselves friends with one another. Does that make sense? I mean, that's important. And I would say that if you are going to get involved with and engage this issue, it would be very important to develop a friendship with somebody in the community who is same-sex attracted. And not for the purpose of, this may sound strange, of sharing the gospel with them, although that's important, but just for the purpose of getting to know them. As Christians, we believe the human person has worth and value. And just befriending a person, just for the sake of that they are a creation of God and bear God's image, just befriending them out of that is an end in itself. Okay, so a number of these friends I've developed, and one guy, his name is Jonathan Rauch. He writes for The Atlantic. He's a really brilliant journalist and writer. I think he's one of the most articulate proponents for same-sex marriage and one of the most thoughtful. So I do a lecture series, and I've done it for years, that focus on the family, to bring in people who are not on the typical Christian speaking circuit. you know, thinkers, people that can get us to think and challenge us in a different way. And people know that these are a little more intellectual or a little more thoughtful. And I wanted to have Jonathan come to focus on the family to speak. And my reason for that, I'll explain that, but like, okay, Glenn, you want one of the most articulate and bright gay activists to come, and we'll give him a microphone to speak to our employees for a whole hour, completely uninterrupted. You know, yeah, not gonna happen. But I said, if we are going to engage this issue, why don't we hear from somebody who actually believes these things and say, okay, here is what they believe, rather than assuming we know what they believe. Just like if they invited one of us, you know what, I don't know any evangelicals, you guys, evangelicals are weird, I think I know what you believe, but would you come and just explain to me what evangelicals actually believe? That would be a smart thing of that person to do that. So I convinced the folks at Focus, okay, yeah, we'll have Jonathan come. And here's what happened. There were a few people who asked me, like, Glenn, why in the world are you having this guy come? And I would explain it to them. They'd go, okay, that makes sense. Well, Jonathan came, and he was nervous. I mean, he's like, I'm going into the belly of the beast. And I said, well, I'm not going to show you where, you know, we have the flying monkeys, like from Wizard of Oz, you know, and all that evil stuff. He comes and he speaks, and he got to speak for 50 minutes, and then I was going to interview him. And he speaks, and he gets a very good applause, a very welcoming applause. And when he got done, after his 50 minutes, he got a standing ovation at Focus on the Family. Now, why do you think he might have got a standing ovation other than the obvious? Why do we give somebody a standing ovation? You just nailed it. You convinced us, you spoke the truth, and you did it so wonderfully. Do you think that is why the employees at Focus on the Family gave him a standing ovation? No, it wasn't. Why do you think? He did a good job. He was articulate. He was nice. To make him feel welcomed, okay? Jonathan's my friend. It brought tears to me, seriously, because just these mean people, I mean, get this, the mean people at Focus who will not serve a gay individual a cake and all that kind of stuff, you know, that we know is just bunk, right? This gay man comes, the most articulate, and they gave him a standing ovation. That standing ovation was saying, Jonathan, we know it was hard for you to come here. We thank you for coming here. We thank you for sharing your heart and helping us understand who you are. And what got me emotional was I didn't have to, like, you know what would be cool afterwards, guys, is to give him a standing. It just happened. And John was blown away because he knew, okay, I convinced everybody. He knew that was the audience's love being shown back to him. And it just blew him away. And I said, John, I did not orchestrate that at all. And he left there that day with two things, okay? One, stinking Focus on the Family invited me into their realm to speak. They didn't censor me. They didn't give me guidelines. They didn't tell me what I could and couldn't say. They just let me speak. And they gave me a standing ovation, which was clearly an action of love to me. Here's the cool thing, guys, strategically, and I didn't do it for this, but when Jonathan goes back to his community, so, dude, what was it like at Focus? I mean, did they try to convert you? And, you know, what names did they call you? You know what? Actually, it was the complete opposite. You know, I mean, that's a powerful thing to be able to accomplish there. That kind of change. Now, I have yet to be invited, or any of my friends have yet to be invited to any of the major gay organizations to explain our position. You know, I mean, we are the closed-minded ones and they're the open-minded ones, but it is so amazing just who really is the closed-minded fundamentalist. And I call it, what we see out there and what we're seeing is the new fundamentalism. Don't tell me about what you believe. I already know what I believe. I know what is truth. And don't try to convince me with anything else. I understand the way everything is. That's that kind of closed-minded fundamentalism, but that's the left. The right is willing to listen. We read their books. They do not read our books because we're intellectually curious, things like that. I want to get into some other stories just real quick about times on the road and what I experience. As I'm going out, and some of my friends have just been, if you will, chagrined at the way that I'm treated sometimes. They'll introduce me, hey, I want you to meet my friend from Focus on the Family, Glenn Stanton. I put my hand out. Sometimes, a few times, they will not put their hand out to shake my hand. You know? He's a gay man. He's a transgender individual. I'll shake their hand. I'll hug them. One time, I got to go out to lunch with this group after an event, and there was this trans woman, and she was in process, and she wasn't quite real good at becoming the woman that she thought she was, and she was really, really sweet. I really do mean that, and I enjoyed talking with her, and when I was getting ready to leave, she said, excuse me, can I give you a hug? I've never hugged anybody from the religious right, and I'm like, okay, sure, and I go, I've never hugged a woman that used to be a man. And she laughed. She loved that. But we see these different individuals and interact with them as real people. But I want to tell you just a few quick stories of these are real experiences at college campuses. And I'm going to start with the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And I got invited to come debate Evan Wolfson, who is probably the first LGBT leader on the other side that started advocating seriously for same-sex marriage back in the 80s and 90s. And he is, I don't mind saying this, I do not like him. He is a slippery guy. He says things that he knows are not true and that I know are not true. And he knows that I know that they're not true, if that makes sense. He just, you know what, he just has no value or virtue whatsoever in that way. And I've debated him a couple of times, but this night at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, we are in this wonderful theater, this old theater, wood seats, wood paneling, it goes up, and Wisconsin Public Radio was sponsoring this debate. And so Evan was, he spoke first, and he's very, very good at what he does. And I come up, and I do what I always do. And I'll give you the two parts of that. First part doesn't really have to do with the story, but it's important for you to know. I come up and say, I am Glenn Stanton from Focus on the Family. If you don't know about us, here's what we believe. And, you know, typically the very leftist audience knows. But I say, I come here with one interest, one motivation, and that is I want to see as much things growing and blossoming in our community as possible that enhance human well-being. Those things that enhance human well-being, I want to see as much of that as possible. Those factors in society that diminish human well-being, I want to see as little of those as possible. And I say, does anybody disagree with that as a criteria in how to approach an issue? What I've just done there is brought everybody to the same place. Nobody can say, no, I don't agree with you. You know, the details of how we do that, that's where we really get disagreeing. But to say that, and you know what that is? Love of neighbor, right? And so immediately, you're the guy from Focus who has just put everybody on the same page with one another. Okay, maybe he's a little different than we thought. Now the next thing. And so to get into the specifics, I say, and I'm at the lectern, big, big theater, and I say, my basic premise here tonight is based in this, that we are all human beings, that's my assumption, and humanity exists universally around the world as male and female, period. Okay, I know what is going to happen when I say that, because it is as if I had insulted their mascot. You know, just like, in fact, if I had insulted their mascot, the reaction would not be stronger and more negative and vicious. When I say that humanity exists as male and female, the place erupts in equal part boos, hisses, and laughter. Now, I have never been hissed before, but I was hissed there, and I made a point of that, okay? So here's what I do. They, again, at the lectern, and they're like, you know what, let's have fun with this guy. We weren't that way with Jonathan when he came to us, but these people, let's have fun with this Yahoo. And they laugh, and they hiss, and they're booing. And so I let them have their fun, because I face this all the time, and I'll tell you some other stories there. So this didn't take me by surprise. So I just stand back. And what they see is like, okay, we are not getting his goat. What's the deal? Well, first of all, I'm used to it. And so I let it die down. And when you step back, they're like, okay, what's the deal? And they died down real quickly. And I came back up and I said, thank you. Let's just capture what happened here. I said, humanity exists in male and female. You could agree or disagree with that, but you booed, laughed, and hissed at me. Seriously, is that how we're going to do this? Now let me continue, and I went on, okay? So NPR, Wisconsin NPR, recorded this thing, and so once they put it up online, I wanted to hear, like, how did that little exchange go? I didn't get to find out how it went because they edited that part out. And it's the thing, you guys, is, okay, I could have tried to engage them intellectually. Well, let me tell you why it's male and female, and, you know, this science and this science and this science, and I can do that, and that's fine. But you just call them out, right? You know, just like, okay, seriously, we're gonna play it this way? And if I left this campus and went over to the biology department, and I said, humanity is made up of male and female, they're like, very good, you get a gold star today, you know? I mean, it's not controversial. But in that room, and you call them out on it. Another time at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, I'm a smaller group, and I say the same thing, and there are some very nice lesbians up front, and I mean that honestly, just, you know, nice, nice ladies, but they're glaring at me. Just glaring at me. And that's the other thing, is like, ladies, how are you? And they don't like to be called ladies. You know, that's, you're being polite, but just don't let them get your goat. And I say the male-female thing, and this one nice lady, she just starts uproariously laughing. And it's a manufactured laugh. Like, how could you be so silly? And I said, excuse me, what is your name? My name's Cindy. I said, Cindy, I just want you to know, I wake up every morning and I pray, Lord, please, please, if you do anything with my life today, let me bring joy to somebody. And Cindy, today you were that person. And just Cindy is like, her friends are like, okay, yeah, and Cindy's just heaping coals, you know, upon their head in that way. And like, Cindy, seriously, I'm glad that I could bring you some enjoyment. That kind of attitude has really helped me to do well in this, not to persuade people, but just to be able to do it. And like, you know, the rest of the audience, the kind of people who kind of keep quiet, and they may be on the other side, but they're like, you know what, that guy's all right. He just, you know, he doesn't let them get him, and nor does he fight back. He just, you know what, are we really going to do it this way? So that's sort of the anger, the bitterness that you get, and you haven't even said anything yet. And I will ask them, sometimes, you know, how many people think that I'm, and I'll just throw out the accusations, a bigot. How many think that I'm, you know, closed-minded, this, 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 and the other? And people will raise their hand like they know. The thing you say then is, oh, have we met? I mean, do you know anything about me? You know, what you're making is an assumption about me. You're prejudging me, which is the root of prejudice. And you just like, okay, you know what? I'll listen to you. Okay, now we're on the same page. This is what we do in the university. We listen to people. Then we judge them based on what they actually say rather than what we have pre-assumed about them. And so the situation on the campuses today are so bad that it is so easy just to kind of do these judo moves with them and just be different than they think. And then to be able to interact, and sometimes I'll have those people come up and go, you know, Mr. Stanton, don't agree with what you said, but I appreciate your spirit, and I appreciate you calling us out on some of those points. Well, you know what? Thank you, and I appreciate it. What's your name? I always ask them, shake their hand, look them in the eye, and ask them their name, you know, and just something about them, because they're people that you want to connect with as people. I want to tell you just a couple of really quick stories that we're going to highlight more in this next talk that I give, but they are just remarkable inconsistencies. And one of them really sets us up for this next talk, The Five Fatal Flaws of Gender Theory. I got invited to go to this multi-campus symposium of a couple of universities up in Denver. They're just right up the road from us in Colorado Springs. So I went up, and they were nice enough of, we're going to have this thing on gender. And it was, the title of it was The Cancer of Heteronormativity. Heteronormativity is this very fancy word for hetero, like most people, normativity, that this idea that being heterosexual is normal, or the norm. Okay, first of all there, how many people are same-sex attracted in the world? They will even admit it's 2 to 3%. What are all the rest of the people? They're heterosexual. 98-97% seems normative to me. Not normal necessarily, but normative. But they're saying, no, heteronormativity is a bad thing. So they invite this guy from Focus, and I'm there and I'm participating. And the professor, and again, I mean, this makes this work fun because you cannot make this stuff up. And when I come in, I'm like, okay, what am I going to experience today? And this is what I experienced on this particular day. The sponsoring professor was giving the opening talk, and it really was. I'll tell you what the talk was. It was really a good talk. But he said, now, I'm Professor Simpson. I'm from the communications department, and you cannot know whether I am a male or female just simply by looking at me. You would have to hear my story, know my story, and learn from me what it is and how I identify. And everybody in the audience was like, oh yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, basically he was reiterating, you know, the first commandment of gender theory, right? Okay, so like, could I take a guess? You know, just a stab at what I think maybe you are, but I didn't do that. His talk was, and this was the good talk, was sexism in advertising, and how in advertising, women are portrayed in a particular way as sexual objects to be consumed, and that men are consumers of women. You know what? Dude, you could come give that talk at Focus on the Family. We're right there. So what he did was he showed slide after slide after slide of advertisement of these kinds of things. Notice the woman, how she's down on the ground and these men are over her in an aggressive sort of way. And then look at this next picture. See the woman, she's on all fours and, you know, I mean, just ad after ad after ad with those kinds of things. What was interesting, first of all, was these were not Field and Stream advertisements, you know, or advertisements from the Walmart circular of, you know, the backwoods people where the men are men and the women know their place, right? No, these were flashy, fancy New York, LA, Paris fashion magazines where the sophisticated people come from. And they were sexist, just plain sexist. Okay, so he goes through about 20 ads. Here's the men, here's the women, and look how the women are, look how the men are. And now you're in this symposium with me, pretend, and you're paying attention. Okay, he told us that we can't know whether he's a male or a female just by looking, and we have to ask him his story and understand his story to really understand who he is. But then his talk, and now we go to, okay, I'll open it up for questions, the professor says. My hand goes, what do you think my question was? And I'm not that smart, right? I mean, like, okay, I've got a question. Professor, just really trying to pay attention here and make sure that I know what's going on. And you opened your comments, and this is a part of the story. I said, you opened your comments saying that we could not know who you are. And according to gender theory, you know, you're absolutely right. And I respect that. And I think it's important for me to know who you are and what your story is and to respect you in that way. But then your presentation, you went on to tell us definitively who the women were and who the men were in the ads. Apparently, I don't think you've met all those models, but you seem to do it based on just observing them. And here's the sad part. It's not good for me in the audience to say, oh crap, but if he had an oh crap moment, like, that's a good point. I never thought about that. I mean, seriously. And you're like, I want to be able to take you seriously, you know, that there's some kind of coherence in your belief system here. And a lot of the other students were like, wow, never thought about that. But that's what we find. They are not thinking about even the most basic parts of it. Now, the student who was hosting this evening, when she was introducing heteronormativity, that term, and they throw it out there like, oh, it's so sophisticated and most of you don't understand it. But here's what heteronormativity means. It means the assumption that everybody is straight. Okay? This is a university. We are very careful about the way we define things. And I just wanted to go, you know what, Glenn Stanton, Focus on the Family, I am not heteronormative because I do not believe that everybody is straight. I'm assuming some people in this room are not straight, and I have no real problem with that. I mean, like, seriously, that's how we're going to define our terms in that way? In just such a lazy sort of way. Heteronormativity is the assumption that everybody is straight. There is nobody that is heteronormative then, because most of us are aware that, you know what, not everybody is like me. People are different. I mean, just absolutely remarkable in that way. It's interesting that it is so easy, if you will, to just knock this sort of stuff over. Because there are ideas out there that are bad ideas, but they're rigorous ideas. You know, like Dick and we've, you know, Marxism, socialism, okay? Bad ideas, but there's a philosophical base behind it that does hold together in, it doesn't completely hold together, but it doesn't contradict itself at every turn. It has a misunderstanding of the human nature and human drive, but there is philosophy behind it. There is, if you will, some logical thought behind it to connect some things together. In the gender world, this stuff, there has never been anything taught on college campuses today as a discipline of study that is more made up out of thin air than gender studies. And I do not say that as sort of, we'll take that, you know, as a glancing blow at them. It just is. As we'll see this weekend, a little bit tonight, and then some tomorrow, it is not rooted in any bit of science whatsoever. In fact, it is incredibly anti-science, contrary to science. And it is stunning. It is stunning to see this. I started saying in my campus talks, I said, folks, there is a tighter connection body of knowledge-wise. The body of knowledge in this department, in the biology departments, there's a greater connection between what they know and the religion department on this campus than there is between the biology department and the gender studies department. The religion and the biology, they can talk about things, and the religion people can talk about things that the biology people go, yeah, well, of course, you know, that's true, and vice versa. These two groups can not only cannot talk, they are opposed to one another. This group needs to pretend that in biology, there is not such a thing as male and female. Reproduction, procreation, that's the one of the driving forces of nature. They really, literally do have to create a complete alternate universe that works according to their own rules and how they would like for it to exist. And again, you guys, I do not say that just rhetorically, like, you know, they're so dumb. It is actually how things are. And here's the other thing about it. It is bleeding off the campus. It'd be one thing if those two buildings over on campus, those are the gender studies buildings, and you know what, just let them do what they do. They like it, they fits their worldview, and you know, if they want to go study that, let them knock themselves out. But here's what's happening is, no, California law, if I say I am a woman, then you have to refer to me as a woman. And if you do not, the law will work against you. You could be deeply, deeply fined, put in jail, your public reputation absolutely defaced. And I mean, you guys know this. Public reputation absolutely slimed. Oh my goodness, that's what many of these people will do. And so it is even moved beyond the sort of live and let live worldview. You know what? You do what you do. Don't bother me. And I'll do what I do, and I won't bother you, and, you know, that sort of pluralism sort of thing. But now, again, it is not just the liberal, close-minded fundamentalism, but that social fascism. The religious right, I grew up in it. I've worked at the headquarters of, you know, one of its places. We are the ones that go out and tell people what to do and how to live and get in their bedrooms and, you know, telling them exactly what they should be doing. You know what? We weren't paying attention in class then when we learned that day how to make people do what they should be doing. You know, these people are masters at it. And they do not tolerate any dissent whatsoever. But I will tell you this, and we'll wrap up with this a little bit tomorrow as well. We were talking about it at lunch, that things are getting worse and worse and worse. We just see it. But here's the kind of undercurrent of it. Satan cannot help but overreach. For Christians, we look at the center of our faith is the cross. And Satan got the second person of the Trinity, God, to die, to be absolutely, utterly humiliated on a cross and die. That was a high point on Satan's work list. Seriously. You know what? Game over. And the disciples thought it was game over. But we know what the cross was. It was that turning point that set everything else free. Satan overplayed his hand and he thought he won, but he sealed his own doom. Now, we have people in society, and we need to know. We need to know. And how are we on time? I haven't heard from my friend here, so.
7 minutes.
7 minutes. Okay, cool. You had 2 minutes. I took that away from you. I'm sorry. A chance to yell at the speaker. That what we are seeing is, let me say this, that when we say they are overplaying their hand, I do not mean any and everyday gay or lesbian individual. There are gay and lesbian individuals who, they're just trying to live their lives, trying to make sense out of their lives, find meaningful relationships, trying to hold their jobs down, trying to do all those things. We disagree with them, we think that they're wrong, but just like we disagree with a lawyer down the street who's cheating on his wife. You know, I mean, every one of us, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow, every one of us is in the same boat. We're all victims of this thing called sin and a messed up creation where we are not what we intend to be. So when I talk about this kind of conspiracy, if you will, it is not all the gay and lesbian individuals, but it's some. It's some that know what they're doing, just like there are some good Christian people who are up to very bad things that aren't in line with, you know, what we believe as Christians. But a lot of these people are and will overplay their hand, okay? So many people support same-sex marriage for the purpose of, you know what, good Frank and Bill next door, they're two nice guys. Why can't they get married? They're, you know, they're sweet men. You know, what does it take away from me? But then when you come to the place of, okay, well, the wedding cake thing, the wedding photographer thing, here's another thing of three or more legal parents. That in California, they have been moving this bill, even before Obergefell, the same-sex marriage Supreme Court decision. They did this in Canada quickly after they passed same-sex marriage, and that is the move that two people who have a child can have assigned more than two legal parents to that child. Three, four, five, six. Why would that be? Well, it's really quite logical and, if you will, conservative idea. And here's what it is. And the point that I'm trying to make with this is, okay, Bill and Frank next door, two nice guys, they want to get married. You know what? What skin is it off my back? It's not going to have any other implications beyond that. Well, this more than two legal parents thing, Bob and Frank, they're 26, 28 years old. They want to become parents. They want to bring children into their family, okay? They have to go next door and borrow an egg from the female side of reality, right? And so they will go to the female side, get an egg, or take their material over to that side and get a surrogate mother. But basically, it's brought their side over to the female and the female to the male. And they'll say, well, this woman carried our child for 9 months. And our child is her biological progeny because we used her egg. And so in the conservative sense, we're the two dads, but this is the mom as well. And we believe that our child should have access to his mom. So we want to assign her legal parentage. Again, it's an odd sort of, don't you guys believe moms are important? You know, it's a conservative sort of argument. And then that woman, sometimes we want her partner too because they're a unit. So we want this child to have four parents. And that is really more common than you would imagine. And you think that goes along and it's logical with that system, right? Okay, I signed on for John and Frank getting married. I had no idea it was going to redefine what parentage meant. And these kinds of things that once you mess up the water table, if you will, you don't know what's going to come. And so Satan continues to push his hand, push his hand, push his hand. And there are going to be people who say, you know what, I was on board with Frank and Jim, but I never knew it was going to go this far. And I never knew these people were going to be so demanding that we respect everything they do and that I've got to use he pronouns for she and vice versa just because this, I mean, like, okay, this thing's gotten out of control. And that's not going to put the genie back in the bottle, but it is going to show that sin, evil, just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. And that is what I think is going to happen. It will continue to happen, but it is up to us to help illustrate and help individuals understand, like, oh yeah, that is pretty crazy. You know, and it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. That's what I've been seeing on the campuses. That's what you guys are seeing in the news. And it's going to continue. And we don't have to be experts at engaging these issues. It's not bad to read up on the topics and things like this. But just to know, I am not going to be pushed any farther than I've been pushed now. And here's the place that I stop. And I'll explain to you why I will not and refuse to be pushed any farther. And just to take your stand as a citizen, as a person that will not be bullied, but not to be bullied in love and care and concern always for the individual, the other individual, which we'll talk about more.
Stay there. Don't go away.
Not going anywhere.
One of the things that you've noticed about this guy, a couple months ago he sent me an article, and I encourage you to get on and read his articles. And I said, Glenn, you're a snarky little devil. And he said, yes. Chip, chip, chip. You just chip, chip, chip away. I'm pretty sure you know both of the McDowells.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sean was here 2.5 years ago. And by the way, a prayer project with us, we're working on getting both of them together back. So, and they have a particular subject they want to talk about. But when he was here, he talked about meeting Matthew Vine and going to some of the meetings that the Reformation Project was doing.
Yes.
And that sounds like you're just getting in bed with them, but there's something about knowing the other side's arguments. There's also something about diffusing that barrier from our side so that we can have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you. And it's interesting to praise Dick real quick. He sent me an email. I sent him an article. He wrote me back, and it just said, chip, 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 chip. How, you know, like, okay, what does that mean? He got it, and he got what I was trying to do. You know what? You don't T-bone the argument. You know, you just try to chip away, chip away, chip away, and that's smart, and Dick, you recognize that.
By the way, I figured out that you probably haven't noticed that my computer's just been going crazy. Well, it's a Bill Gates thing.
There you go.
Let's take a break for 10 minutes, and then I'll call you back. And if you can buy a book, you want to do that, give us a check if you can. Oh, can I have your attention for just a minute before you go?